O'Connor, relate. Do you think that military command and military decision making is a particularly lonely position to be in?
Particularly
lonely position to be in. I mean, is it something which you can share, or something which you really have to
carry
yourself?
I know what you mean exactly. I think perhaps it is, but if you've got a good staff that you can discuss things with and whom you trust, that burden is shared without any doubt at all. I mean, I was so happy with my staff, so I had such a good one, and I didn't feel really that that I was left alone. I mean, I definitely had to make the final decision about everyone, every operation, and naturally I was prepared to do that. But having done so, or having, before I did so, I was helped greatly by having discussed it with my staff, and having done so, and having come to the decision, I didn't find then any great difficulty.
At the end of the Libyan campaign, how did you evaluate the importance of your success?
Well, it surprised me considerably that I'd been as successful as this campaign turned out to be, and especially as we'd had that pause of a month, because as I said before, that lost us our surprise and exploitation. So we had to start again from scratch. And I didn't expect that we'd have the success that we did in my second venture, because, well, I didn't know that we'd get Bardia. I mean, after 3 or 4 days fighting, I didn't think we'd necessarily get to Tobruk. And then we had a long way to go, and we had no idea of the way to do it. And at the most, I expected that we might perhaps capture Benghazi or Gaza and push the enemy in front of us. I had no idea that we'd be able to cut them off. I hadn't really studied it enough to say. And liquidate the whole of the 10th Army.
Considered in the context of the whole course of the war, how important did you think your own campaign was? What was its contribution, looked at in the international...
Well, I think it was a contribution to morale as much as anything else, and had we really been able to profit by it, it would have been much more important than it was. We didn't have profit by it. One way or another, we allowed the Germans to arrive, and we had all this terrible fighting in the desert that followed. And so we didn't get the profit that we might have from it, or immediate profit anyway. But I think it did a great service to morale.
Whose morale?
Don't you think so? Well, I think the morale of the nation.
Yes.
And you were to know that naturally the morale of the people who took part in it, but the morale much further than that, who welcomed the first sign of a victory, which really it was. But I would always say, I mean, for my own self, never consider this an operation that was carried out except against the Italians. I mean, I don't evaluate it myself as anything like what a great many other people have done in possibly smaller operations against the Germans. I mean, the real thing was that we were able to exploit the weakness of the Italians, and our tactics were such that we were able to overcome the big superiority, because we were able to, in fact, we were able to realize that if our tactics were good, we should probably be able to defeat them.
Yes.
But it wasn't up to a battle against the Germans.
It's interesting that you should single out the importance of the campaign from a morale point of view. Does it surprise you that your own part in the campaign received comparatively little popular acknowledgement or formal acknowledgement?
Not a bit, really. I mean, I got promotion and some awards, and I thought that was all I deserved. I mean, I didn't expect any more. I was quite satisfied with what you got.
I wondered if your own slight quality of diffidence, of not sort of being inclined to shout your own praises, was a contributory reason why your name wasn't as popularly known as some other.
Well, I think there were so many other things to that were happening, really, that took one's mind off those things. I mean, nobody really thinks about a thing if there are a lot of other important things that are going on. And was very much praised for the result of that, the capture of Benghazi, which they thought of some importance, and so on, and the defeat of the army. But that was, in a few days they were thinking of something else. And I don't think really that there was, I didn't feel in any way that it was not given sufficient prominence. Because there were other things that were more important for falling on its heels, really. Everything, there only seemed to be one sort of tactics, is just following behind a barrage. And I feel that I feel that at any rate that one, it was important that one should adopt tactics that fitted every operation, and they should be and could be necessarily entirely and absolutely different, so that you got the best value from your particular arms you were armed with at the time. I mean, if you were very strong on artillery, well, you had to make something that gave artillery the best scope, or infantry, or in a case like we had, a bit of form with armored division. I mean, you had to make definite plans for the particular obstacles you've got to overcome.
Mm. Mm. We didn't say a great deal about the complementary use of the armored division as the sort of mobile support arm of the I-tanks. We concentrated a lot on the I-tanks.
Yes.
We didn't say too much about the armored division.
Yes, well, the armored division were absolutely first class throughout. And I was very, very lucky to have them. And their training was such, and that they did all the operations that we asked them to do. And in particular, the 11th Hussars with Colonel Coombe, I mean, they were the spearhead of everything, really, and they did extraordinarily well. And, of course, the armored division gave tremendous scope for mobility, and therefore you wanted to try and produce situations which gave scope for that mobility. And as it turned out, these things rather played into our hands. It wasn't that we were being very clever about it. They were almost presented to us on a plate. Mm. And it seemed rarely to me that there were very few things that one could have done except what we did do.
You mentioned that the armored division had been trained by General Hobart.
Yes.
Or Hobo, as you
yes.
called him. Hobart appears, from the little I have read, to have been one of the British officers who had thought a good deal about the tactics of
yes.
using armored forces. And
yes.
I think that he was, disciple would be the wrong word, but I think that he did think very closely in line with Little Horace's views about
I think
the
he probably
Islamic.
Did. And I think he was he really was. He was a very good commander of the armored division. And he had unfortunate propensity of quarrelling with his superiors all the time. And he, if it hadn't, I mean, he was his own worst enemy and could have got on much, much quicker. And I hardly knew him, really, when he was commanding that division. I hardly knew him then, because I was only, afterwards, I only met him for a short time. Mm. But I knew him, actually, in France, from D-Day onwards and before D-Day, where his ingenuity made it possible for us to carry out the landing on D-Day. And all the time he was commanding this 70-something division, which had all the peculiarities that we required for our flares to set off mines and all sorts of things. That were his own invention. And he's no doubt he was a most remarkable man with a tremendous technical knowledge and great inventive power. And I think we owe a tremendous debt to him as a commander. Tremendous.
He'd obviously prepared 7th Armoured Division tremendously well for
the campaign. Very well indeed. And he equally trained his 70th Division for this other thing quite incredibly well, but he fought with everyone in between. And he's brother-in-law to Lord Montgomery, you know. Mm. And I think that he and Monty managed to get on without fighting very well, really.